Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the emergence of an orchestrated campaign led by Fox News to delegitimize the Robert Mueller investigation and cast it as a Democratic plot to undermine Trump's election victory in the Electoral College. David Mindich, a professor and chair of the journalism department at Temple University and author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism, joins us to discuss how Trump watches between 4 and 8 hours of television a day, tuning into Fox News for the comfort it provides him, while occasionally watching MSNBC to get riled up and ready for combat. We'll examine this un-American relationship between a sitting government and a volunteer ministry of truth, which Fox has become under Rupert Murdoch, who talks to Trump every day and appears to set the agenda for the White House talking points and policies, as well as assess what work the president actually does, given his television watching habit, which suggests the reality TV star is more interested in his reviews than his performance. Then we'll go to Montgomery, Alabama, for an update on Tuesday's election for the U.S. Senate seat that is both shaping up as Trump's Waterloo and a referendum on America itself, with the child molester likely to win against a former U.S. attorney who successfully prosecuted the KKK. Mark Potok, the former director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project, who was a spokesman for the SPLC, joins us from Montgomery, Alabama, to discuss the close race and the concern that turnout of the critical African-American vote may not be sufficient to overcome the expected mobilization of the fundamentalist so-called Christians who see the tribulations of Jesus Christ in their persecuted champion, Roy Moore. Then finally, we'll speak with Lena Hatib, the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House and the former director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. She joins us to discuss the demonstrations in front of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and across the Arab world in response to Trump's gambit to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, and how this is complicating the close ties Trump has forged with the Saudis, who are losing the so-called Arab Street to Iran due to the anger Trump has ignited in the Middle East. And joining us now is David Mindich, who is the professor and chair of journalism department at the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. He's the author of Tuned Out, Why Americans Under 40 Don't Follow the News, and Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism. And his forthcoming book is The Mediated World. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Mindich.
Thank you for having me.
And what did you make of this large investigative piece by the New York Times into Trump's television watching habits, where he watches between 4 and 8 hours of television a day, 8 hours being a normal kind of working day? So it's a pretty shocking revelation that the president is spending so much time basically watching reviews of his performance as opposed to performing as president of the United States.
Right. You know, it's funny because a report that came out around the same time was that he eats something like 2 Big Macs and 2 McDonald's fish fillets a day, in addition to drinking nine Diet Cokes. Whether it's his food diet or his media diet, you know, I think there's a lot to be worried about in this presidency. I laugh, of course, but it's serious. You know, the Times expose involved, you know, dozens of people talking to Times reporters. It's a very detailed report, and we're seeing a lot of these reports about the Trump administration, which really gives us a window on both his day-to-day activities and also how nervous people around him are, and that's why they're speaking off the record, but willingly, or on background, I should say, but willingly to talk about their anxieties around the president. And the TV watching habit, the media diet that he has, is definitely laden not only with calories, but poisons. If you're reading and watching propaganda all day.
Well, propaganda is really the issue here. And I know that it's not unprecedented in the history of American politics, going back to the early days of the Republic, that there wasn't much difference between scandal sheets and the media character assassination and propaganda being synonymous with news. But in the modern era, we've never had a situation where Rupert Murdoch, the head of Fox, apparently talks to Trump every day, more or less settles the talking points as Fox does. So you have a kind of volunteer ministry of truth operating in as the, basically for a sitting government. I mean, that's right. Pretty unprecedented. I mean, that really does have echoes of the Soviet Union.
That's right. I mean, there's nothing since at least 150 years, in the last 150 years of American history, that's anything like that. And really what we have is not only is it a TV network that's friendly to the administration, that's cheerleading, it's really a network that plays fast and loose with the truth. And in fact, we saw this under the Obama administration, and we see it now, that Fox really spends a lot of time twisting their facts to support their beliefs, and particularly the Republican Party. And that's really dangerous. The famous phrase is, everyone has a right to his or her own opinion, but not his or her own facts. And so when they're pushing these contested, these screwy facts and these lies, that really doesn't serve democracy. Because what we want is a set of facts that we can ponder and then make some policy decisions, and voters can hold their leaders accountable. But if facts are twisted, if things are just wrong, then it's propaganda, and then democracy is weakened.
And again, I'm speaking with David Mindich, who's a professor and chair of the Journalism Department at the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. He's the author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism, and his forthcoming book is The Mediated World. Well, the orchestrated campaign to delegitimize Robert Mueller and his investigation is very much underway, and I think it's going to come to a head at the end of the year. And it does seem that the White House, through the White House lawyers, are floating this kind of idea that somehow there's a deadline and that Mueller is going to finish his investigation by the end of the year, which is not true, but they keep saying that, which makes me suspect that that's when they're going to say, well, he's supposed to have ended now and he hasn't, and it's costing us too much, etc. Meanwhile, in the interregnum, the drumbeat is going to start accelerating with Republicans, in particular with Fox News, calling for Mueller to step down. The opening salvo, of course, was fired by Sean Hannity on Fox. And I just let me just read what he said, because it's pretty extraordinary. Let's start off with the head of the snake. Mueller's credibility is in the gutter tonight, and these new discoveries, his conflicts of interest, his clear bias, the corruption are on full display. Mueller is frankly a disgrace to the American justice system and has put the country now on the brink of becoming a banana republic. Now, they're talking about a Vietnam War hero who decorated Vietnam Marine, who's a lifelong Republican and headed the FBI under both Democratic and Republican administrations. I mean, how could this guy be the person that Hannity is portraying?
I mean, the whole Trump administration and the Fox News operation has been just a mystery in terms of like how this can happen in a democratic society. When Trump, I was just talking to some friends about this the other day, that, when Trump said more than a year ago that I like my I like people who weren't captured about McCain. You know, I thought, you know, Trump is finished. I mean, this is, you know, so beyond the pale. You know, the things that Trump has been saying, the things that Hannity's been saying, are so beyond what we think of as reasonable discourse, and yet it continues. I mean, it would be unfathomable that that a special prosecutor, as he is nearing collecting these really damning things about the collusion, the possible collusion, which now looks like likely collusion between the Trump people and the Russians, that he would be fired. You know, one thing that's not talked about maybe enough is that there's a difference between Watergate and today, and the central difference is that there were Republicans with backbones who were willing to stand up to Nixon. And, you know, there's a Democratic majority, but, you know, it was a Congress that was really willing to act if Nixon would have gone too far. And when he did go too far, the famous Saturday Night Massacre and such. But, you know, there isn't a sense that there are Republicans who are willing to stand up to Trump and begin impeachment proceedings if that's the way it goes. So, you know, the journalism benefits from two parties who are honest brokers in this in a political debate, and the Republican Party as a whole hasn't been willing enough to look at the facts of the case and to really be troubled by what they certainly would have been troubled by if it were a Clinton or an Obama colluding with Russians to throw an election.
Well, joining the chorus of the Fox News junkyard dogs yapping is Newt Gingrich, who once described Mueller as a, quote, a superb choice to be special counsel. His reputation is impeccable for honesty and integrity. And just on Wednesday, the new Gingrich said, Mueller is corrupt, the senior FBI is corrupt, the system is corrupt. And, of course, that is what Donald Trump said on Friday in Pensacola, Florida, at a rally for Roy Moore. He went on and on about the system is rigged and corrupt. So, of course, Trump himself is laying the groundwork for this idea that this is a conspiracy of the so-called deep state to get rid of the president. What's your sense then? I mean, I mentioned the role of Rupert Murdoch because of his influence in the media, controlling the mouthpiece for the Trump administration and essentially arranging the daily talking points. But it does also feel like the ghost of Roy Cohn is in the Oval Office, Roy Cohn being Trump's mentor. This seems to be straight out of Roy Cohn's playbook, just to slash and burn, take no prisoners, truth doesn't matter, just slime anybody and anyone who says anything against you and, you know, fight back, you know, a thousandfold, which is pretty much Trump's M.O.
Right. The question is, so, you know, a lot of people compare Fox and MSNBC and say, well, on one side you got Fox and on the other side you have MSNBC. But Fox really is alone in terms of, you know, cable networks in that it really doesn't adhere to truth and reporting as we know it. So, you know, Rachel Maddow is, in a way, the mirror image of some of the right-wing anchors on Fox. But Rachel Maddow's show is so carefully crafted, and she's so precise in her reporting and in her commentary that it really is, I mean, everyone should be watching her show if they wanted to get at least a slightly partisan take on the news, but that's really grounded in reality and facts. There's no equivalent of that on Fox, where facts are paramount. And certainly Hannity and Newt Gingrich and other right-wing propagandists are not just the equivalent of left media.
But this is the problem, isn't it? Joseph Goebbels, who invented modern media propaganda, even though in those days there was only the movies and radio. But the person who's really perfected it is Vladimir Putin through his so-called political technologist, Surkov. And there's a very, really good book written about it called Everything is True and Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. That's the tactic. It's just to throw stuff out there to it's what Bannon does. You know, he's a practitioner of Putin's media cynicism. So this is what I think is scary, is that we are essentially, you know, a big chunk of the American media landscape is now indistinguishable from the kind of media that you have in authoritarian countries like Russia, China, and now in Poland and in Hungary and Turkey, etc.
I think that's right. The one thing that I'll say is that Trump's approval rating right now is in the 30s, right? Well, the Pew poll, I think, had him at 32% or 34%. And Pew is, one of the leading pollsters. And to have that kind of approval rating suggests that a lot of Americans are really understanding that he's a dangerous guy, and his version of reality is not our version of reality. And it may be that we'll have to wait 11 months until the elections to see that. And I know that you're going to be talking later on your show about the Alabama election, which, if it's close, it's still also a sign that, that even people in Alabama are starting to question Trump's agenda. It could be that the corrective is going to come in a year from now. But a lot can happen in a year, and so it's a dangerous situation that we're living in. And it's frightening to think that we might have to wait a year until Congress changes fundamentally and making impeachment a possibility and holding Trump in check. And it might not happen in a year, but I think that might be the next milestone to look for.
Well, I think the next milestone might well be in a month. I think Trump really will try to shut down Mueller one way or the other, and he's laying the groundwork through Fox News propaganda, and that is surely going to precipitate some kind of political crisis, if not a constitutional crisis. I know we've only got a minute to go here, but...
Well, the question is what the Republicans will do in response, because the Democrats will do not have the power to impeach, but they certainly have the power to impose to oppose. But we'll see whether if Trump does something catastrophic like firing Mueller, whether in fact there is a backlash.
Well, David Mindich, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Mindich, who's a professor and chair of the Journalism Department at the Klein College of Media and Communication at Temple University. He is the author of Just the Facts, How Objectivity Came to Define American Journalism, and his forthcoming book is The Mediated World. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to Montgomery, Alabama, for an update on Tuesday's election for the U.S. Senate seat that is shaping up as Trump's Waterloo and a referendum on America itself.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
the best laid plan. Swing low, Alabama. You got the spare change. You got to feel strange. And now...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Montgomery, Alabama, is Mark Potok, the former director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report, and the Hate Watch blog, and acted as a spokesman for the SPLC, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. And he's testified before the Senate and the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights and other venues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Well, thanks for having me in.
And Mark, since you're there in ground zero on this, in the state that's got the nation's attention, Tuesday is this critical vote. It's sort of shaping up in many ways as a kind of Waterloo for Donald Trump. He's pulling out all the stops, robocalling on behalf of Roy Moore, effectively campaigning down there in the neighboring state on the Florida Panhandle, which shares a big media market with Alabama. And as far as people abroad are concerned, is it's looking like or shaping up like a kind of referendum on the United States itself, the idea that a child molester and a racist could be elected to the U.S. Senate and defeat a guy who's got such a sterling record as a prosecutor who brought about final justice for the young girls that were bombed in the Birmingham church, finally bringing justice to these KKK guys. So... is this really a case of the good guy versus the bad guy, and that the bad guy might win?
Yes, it is a case of the good guy versus the bad guy, and the bad guy very well may win. I mean, the problem, in a sense, aside from, you know, Alabama's extremely long history of reactionary politics and racist politics, is that as a result of that history, as one result, you know, Alabamians are incredibly uptight about the perception of being told what to do or mocked by quote-unquote outsiders, those damn Yankees. So, you know, that is what is driving the support for Moore as much as, you know, his being the Ten Commandments judge and, you know, going after gay people and all the rest of it. It really is quite extraordinary thing to see. You know, on the other hand, the very newest poll now has Doug Jones 4 points ahead of Roy Moore, which is pretty remarkable. But, you know, I think it's been said, and I think it's true, that polling in this state is very primitive. There's not a lot of experience on the part of national polling firms polling here, and they haven't done very well. So, you know, one thing I can tell you as someone who lives down here is it is a hell of a thing to find a Roy Moore sign around here. I haven't seen one yet in this campaign. And in fairly well-to-do, fairly white neighborhoods in Montgomery, there are quite a lot of Doug Jones signs. So we'll see what that means. But that, of course, is the hope of progressives down here in a big way, that, you know, you're actually going to have a significant number of Republican women who would normally vote for a Roy Moore who are just too disgusted. You know, it's been interesting to look at the way women in Alabama react. You know, I mean, a goodly number of them are, you know, flat out don't believe it. You know, this is the Washington Post and other evil outsiders, you know, conspiring to do all that's good and right down here. But then there are an awful lot of people on the other side as well who you know, I think feel, and rightly so, that it was very, very difficult to say these women were lying. You know, if you know the stories of each of the women and what they said, it seems pretty patently clear that Moore did exactly what he is accused of doing.
Yeah, but just the other day at the rally in Pensacola, Florida, on Friday, President Trump more or less said the women lied, at least the woman who Roy Moore wrote in her yearbook, and apparently she added apparently a note at the bottom to remind her of what the time and place and venue was.
Yeah, and, I mean, what a ludicrous charge on the part of the Republicans, you know, because she put underneath his comment in her yearbook, she notated the restaurant where she was working at the time. You know, this is supposed to be some kind of conspiracy, and it's obviously not. But yeah, the more people are trying to make something of it. I mean, you know, I don't know how much Trump really matters down here. I mean, obviously, you know, he himself is a person who has accused all 19 women who've had something to say about Donald Trump groping and attacking them sexually are liars, right? So when he says or implies that all of Moore's accusers are liars, too, you know, I think even people on both sides of the divide down here kind of shrug their shoulders. But it has been remarkable to see. And, you know, Moore has changed his story a number of times. You know, initially, well, he knew a couple of the women, and they were good girls, you know, their mommies, you know, they respected what their mommies told them and so on. You know, now the claim is he doesn't know any of them at all. So apparently, in the last couple of weeks, he's completely forgotten knowing a couple of these women. So, you know, it's very much like Donald Trump, right, saying, oh, I'm so sorry for what I said on the Access Hollywood tape, and now, you know, 10 months later or whatever it is, saying, that's not my voice on the Access Hollywood tape.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's a former director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. He also edited the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, and he acted as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. I spoke recently with the novelist Diane McWhorter, from who wrote the book about coming home to Birmingham, and she made the point that what Roy Moore is signaling down there to his supporters, and they may well not be talking to pollsters, is that basically in Alabama, Democrat is synonymous with black, and the dishonest media, as Donald Trump rails against, and the fake news media, etc., that is a buzzword for Jews. Is that how it strikes you?
Well, more or less. I mean, I have heard very few people here, and I've been here for 20 years now in Alabama, I've heard very, very few people talking about, you know, Jews run the media and that kind of thing. So most kind of racial, ethnic, religious animus down here, excluding Muslims for the moment, you know, is directed at black people. And, you know, it is true that in many ways the Democratic Party is seen as somehow representing black people, but that's not so solid anymore. You know, it is worth remembering that in both Obama elections, all the cities in Alabama went for Obama. So that was Mobile, Birmingham, Montgomery, where I am, and Huntsville. So and so did much of the Black Belt, which is the old plantation belt, where the soil is very black, and it's a section of the middle of the state. So it's not quite monolithic in that way, but yes, I mean, this is a state that is absolutely driven by racial politics. I mean, just to give one example, we have unbelievably low property taxes down here, and it's nice for those of us who own houses. But the reason we have such outrageously low taxes is that white people in Alabama basically see public schools as serving black people, and they will not, white voters will not vote to raise property taxes to serve a public education system that is seen as primarily serving blacks. So, you know, it's just one example of the kinds of politics that really do drive this state.
So does that mean that white kids go to religious schools?
Not all religious schools, and you know, certainly there are white kids in the public school systems, but in Montgomery, I think it's probably around 20% white, maybe a little bit less. And most of those white kids go to magnet schools. So, you know, it is a very black school system by and large. The other kids, I wouldn't say all religious schools, yeah, there are a fair number of those, but it's worth remembering that in the aftermath of desegregation in the South, in very many places, Montgomery very much included, a whole series of quote-unquote academies, private academies, were set up. And these were private schools where whites pulled their kids out of public schools and sent them. You know, today, of course, the academies are not racially exclusive. It's much more class-based. But, you know, as a practical matter, that means that they are very largely white. and that the education given by those academies is generally much better than what you can get in any of the school systems, the public school systems down here.
So if the Democratic Party is seen as the party of African Americans in Alabama, what's your sense then of the turnout? Because I'm reading press reports are saying that African Americans, particularly the young in Alabama, are not that inspired by the white man running, even though he's a good guy.
That's true, and it's really worrying, and it's a bit of a surprise because Doug Jones was the U.S. attorney or one of the U.S. attorneys who prosecuted the murderers who carried out the 16th Street Baptist bombing, the murder of four little black girls. So, but that for reasons that kind of elude me, does not seem to have made Doug Jones particularly famous, in the black community down here. So, yes, there's been a lot of reporting that shows that a lot of black people, a lot of African Americans in Montgomery, where I am, for instance, don't even know that there's a Senate race on, which is amazing because, the airwaves are filled with this. The papers are filled with this pretty much cover to cover for the last few weeks. So that's a big worry. It does seem to, it is, I think, without question, all about turnout. And, I guess one hope is that in addition to more African-Americans turning out than it appears will right now, again, progressives are very much hoping that we're going to see quite a lot of Republicans, and in particular Republican women, not simply declining to vote for anybody, but actually walking out of their houses and casting a vote for the Democratic candidate, for Doug Jones. And that may happen. I think anecdotally, there are quite a lot of stories of couples down here, old couples, where he's going to vote for Roy Moore and she's going to vote for Doug Jones. And by golly, neither of them are thinking about changing their votes to accommodate the other. So it's an interesting moment.
Well, what do you think the impact will be of Richard Shelby, the senator, who's basically saying that, first of all, right out of the gate, opposed Roy Moore, and then just today he again reiterated that he's not the right man for the job. And
my sense is that Shelby is spending down political capital. I mean, good for him for doing that, right. But I think it probably didn't win him any votes. Probably just the opposite. But Shelby has been around for a very long time. I don't think that he is in danger of getting primaried here or in other ways losing his position. In a way, it was a fairly brave thing for him to do, although he is very, very solidly established in Alabama politics. And like I say, I don't think is probably in any danger. But I don't think it's made him, more popular in terms of polling in Alabama.
Well, if Roy Moore is elected, it's a huge victory for Trump. It's because he's really basically, I see it as kind of his political Waterloo. He takes these things deeply personally and he has so little support, but he's holding on to his 35% of whatever it is zealously. But the other person that would be a winner surely would be Stephen Bannon. And, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, basically dismissing Bannon as a nuisance, saying, look at the kind of people that he chooses. He chooses a bunch of losers. And it's true. It's hard to understand what kind of political philosophy Bannon has, putting child molesters in and, Chemtrails Kelly down there in Arizona and all of these other foster frees, this felon from upstate New York. I mean, his choices are just bizarre. And more, apparently, if he got in the U.S. Senate, could basically grind the whole place to a halt. The one senator has that kind of power if he's a complete nutcase, which apparently this guy is. So what's your sense of the collateral damage here? Because to my mind, this is not just about Moore. This is about Trump and Bannon.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, look, it would be a spectacular moment if, in fact, Doug Jones wins, if Moore loses, because I think you're right that, the easily irritatable Donald Trump has very much now put all of his eggs in this basket. If he fails again, having earlier supported Luther Strange in the primary vote and lost, come out on the losing side of that one, it would be quite a moment. And, you know, yes, Roy Moore is Steve Bannon's candidate. I mean, Bannon has been pushing him and pushing Trump to push him, to push Roy Moore. So, you know, it is quite a referendum on all of that. You know, I only wish the referendum were taking place, you know, in another state that might be more willing to take down somebody like Roy Moore.
So when Senator Shelby says that Republicans can do better than Roy Moore, if you're saying that in spite of the airwaves being blasted with all this stuff that a lot of African-Americans aren't aware of it, and my understanding is unless they get out just about every African-American vote, Doug Jones is not going to win. And on the Republican side, you have this sort of possibility of couples splitting, the women voting against Moore. Will they vote? If they vote against Moore, would they abstain, or would they vote for Doug Jones? I mean,
well, that's the big question about Republican women, and you know, and as far as anecdotal reporting, it has seemed like people are going both ways. You know, I'm just not going to vote, or you know, for the first time in my life, I'm going to vote for a Democrat. You know, on the question of black turnout, I mean, I think it's been said that, you know, what we need actually is not 100% black turnout, but 25%. But that's a very high number for a special election. And, you know, one thing about Roy Moore's voters is, you know, they will slog through, you know, rain, sleet, and hail, and, you know, gunfire too, probably, to get to the polls to support their boy. So, you know, that's a worry, that the more people are vastly more committed and enthusiastic than the bulk of Doug Jones's supporters. So that is, I think, a big worry for us.
But the people that you're talking about, the zealous supporters for Roy Moore, are they the evangelicals? Because that seems to be his most ardent support, and that's what he's representing himself politically. You know, he's the guy with the Ten Commandments. And by the way, there is a lot of analysts, and Middle East analysts for that matter. I spoke to one of the editors of Haaretz in Israel the other day, and this move by Trump to move the U.S. embassy in Israel to Jerusalem apparently had more to do with Roy Moore than anything else. It's to shore up the Christian Zionists down there in Alabama who believe in Armageddon and want the state of Israel to precipitate the end of the world so they can get raptured up and the rest of us burn in hell.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, look, I don't know that's what Trump was thinking, but yes, you know, a big hunk of the evangelicals down here are so-called Christian Zionists, and so, you know, while some right-wing Israelis think they're great because they support Israel, you know, they have a rather strange ideology about, you know, Israel has to be destroyed and so on before we can have the second coming. But yes, that does seem possible. You know, look, it's not only evangelicals supporting Roy Moore. I mean, so, you know, I've seen quite a lot of people, you know, I mean, we don't have a whole lot of atheists down here, but people who are essentially non-practicing Christians are also being gung-ho for Roy Moore. And I think that relates a lot to this idea of outsiders are always criticizing us. You know, they're always calling us rednecks and racists and so on down here. You know, and damn it, we've had enough and are not going to take it anymore. So, again, I think that's the worry, the insider-outsider business more than, you know, the church is going to drive Moore's people to the polls.
Well, Mark Potok, I thank you very much for giving us an update on the ground truth, as much as one can divine it, in Alabama. Thank you for joining us.
Well, a real pleasure being with you, and hope to do it again sometime.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, as the former director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. He also edited the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, and he acted as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Montgomery, Alabama, where he joined us from. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and go to the demonstrations in front of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut and across the Arab world in response to Trump's gambit to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem.
¶¶
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lena Hatib, who is the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. She was formerly the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lena Hatib.
Thank you.
And there have been demonstrations today in front of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, turning pretty violent. Obviously, that's a manifestation of a broader anger in the Arab world, and perhaps even more so than the manifestations of protest in the Palestinian territories themselves and in East Jerusalem. So does that tell us something, that there's perhaps even more anger in the broader Middle East than there is in Palestine itself, or is that just a smoldering situation that could ignite into an intifada?
What is happening in the Middle East right now as a reaction to President Trump's announcement about Jerusalem is widespread condemnation of this statement that is being expressed by both leaders as well as citizens. We have seen protests happen in places like Lebanon, as you mentioned, as well as Turkey, and, of course, in Palestinian territories as well. And this tells us that this decision taken by President Trump is only going to fuel grievances and potentially more violence in the region rather than, as he put it, pave the way for peace.
So one of the things that's extraordinary about Donald Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, which would make the U.S. Embassy the only embassy in the whole world being placed in Jerusalem, and that in itself is pretty extraordinary. But one of the motives, which is emerging now, is to do with this critical Senate race in Alabama, that basically Donald Trump was throwing a bone to the Christian Zionists in Alabama. That's pretty pretty unprecedented, that a domestic American political situation would have such extraordinary international ramifications.
But this is not new. In the context of the presidency of Trump, we have seen this from the very beginning, from the days in which he was during which he was campaigning. He had always looked internally to the domestic milieu and made statements about international affairs with a view to using them to appeal to this hardcore constituency that he has been trying to basically court. So this is, I would put it in line with what he said about Iran and tearing up the nuclear deal or building a wall to keep Mexican illegal immigrants away, or the ban on people from certain countries and the Muslim world, largely speaking, to kind of be able to come to the U.S. All these things are mainly about his domestic supporters.
So that's got to be a little unsettling for followers of foreign policy, right, particularly abroad. Is there enough clout amongst other European leaders to make up the difference for an absentee, if not reckless, American presence in the Middle East?
Sadly, what is allowing President Trump to go this far with these statements and sometimes actions is that he is facing very little resistance. The European Union, for example, is no longer a strong political bloc. The situation of the United Kingdom, for example, with Brexit, can only weaken the potential of European countries to stand together and send strong statements, to the United States. The same applies to the Arab world. Sadly, in the Arab world, you see similar processes of foreign policy being used domestically. So, for example, even the Jerusalem protests have been largely politicized, such as the ones we've seen in Lebanon, because the people who have rallied their supporters to go and protest outside the U.S. embassy did not do so just because they were upset about Palestine, but they also did so in order to get political credit for themselves. This paved the way for President Trump to basically engage in this kind of behavior, knowing very well that there's not going to be any serious repercussions.
So is that to say that Trump's actions are a gift to Iran and Hezbollah? Because, you know, we're told that Trump has forged very close ties with the Saudis, and in particular his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has formed a close friendship with MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi leader. Now, it's obviously that maybe in private, the Saudis don't have a problem with what Trump is doing, but in public, they have to be opposed to it. But it would seem to me that that this is an opening for Iran, because there's no question there's a certain closeness between Trump and the Saudis.
Yes, I mean, the problem is that although President Trump has engaged in hard rhetoric about Iran, the actions of the Trump administration are a bit similar to the actions of the Obama administration when it comes to Iran. And decisions like the movement of the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem are great news for Iran, because Iran can then use this in order to tell its supporters, see, we told you so. The United States is not to be trusted. It was never neutral in the peace process. And Iran will definitely use this to present itself as credible. Meanwhile, we are not seeing much change in U.S. action vis-a-vis Iran. So Saudi Arabia is hoping that with President Trump, there might be more action to try to contain Iranian influence in Arab countries. But so far, we haven't seen rhetoric coupled with action, and therefore Iran is simply benefiting from these kinds of statements like the ones about the nuclear deal or the one about Jerusalem. Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example, welcomed the news privately because it could use this to politicize the situation and rally its supporters. So we have to be careful not to just look at what President Trump is saying vis-a-vis his position towards Iran, but actually look at these kinds of contradictory actions and promises that can only make the situation worse.
And again, I'm speaking with Lina Hatib, who is the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. She was formerly the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Now, Lina, do you believe the reports we're getting out of Saudi Arabia? Thomas Friedman, a very influential columnist with the New York Times, gave a glowing review of his long sit-down with MBS, and the idea is that he's a modernizer, a reformer, and that he's going to rein in the excesses of the Wahhabi sect and the arrangement that it's always had with the House of Saud, and somehow mitigate the extraordinary amount of damage that the Wahhabis have done around the world in terms of radicalizing Islam and inspiring all kinds of groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But on the other hand, a lot of analysts see him as being reckless, impulsive, got Saudi Arabia into a war in Yemen that's going nowhere except that he's starving the Yemenis to death, and it's totally chaotic. So what's your review? Where do you come down on that? Those choices, whether he's a reformer or a kind of reckless boy king?
The situation in Saudi Arabia is complex, but what I'm also diagnosing is that some analysts are refusing to see Saudi Arabia except through the very fixed framework of Wahhabism and lack of reform. And so a lot of people are not convinced by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's actions and plans. But what I see is attempts at reform, not necessarily because he himself is a reformist, but out of economic necessity. For Saudi Arabia to survive, for the monarchy in Saudi Arabia to survive, it has no choice but to reform. It has no choice but to privatize the economy. And for that to happen, it has no choice but to allow women to play a greater role in the workforce, which means allowing them to drive and participate in public life. It has no choice but to try to change the oil dependency that it has. And therefore, Mohammed bin Salman, I believe, is genuine about wanting these reforms to happen because they are existential. So when you view it through this prism, you can see that he is determined to make a fundamental change in Saudi Arabia. And let's not forget that the support for Wahhabist jihadism around the world has not done Saudi Arabia any favors. I mean, there are thousands of Saudis who went, for example, to Syria to join the Islamic State terrorist group and who are now coming back to Saudi Arabia. So this crown prince is looking at the situation and trying to deal with the causes of instability to ensure the survival of the monarchy. But at the same time, he is not as politically experienced as his predecessors, because he is the youngest crown prince that Saudi Arabia has had. And therefore, sometimes he appears to be engaging in actions that appear not to be very well thought out.
So does the closeness to Trump help him or hurt him?
The closeness to Trump, I think, can only help him. Because for Saudi Arabia to succeed in the kinds of reforms it needs to do, which are primarily economic and security related, it needs the support of the United States. But as I said, the problem is that at the moment, despite Saudi Arabia's optimism about President Trump perhaps being stronger regarding containing Iran, we haven't seen any real action in that regard in the United States. So, this means that the support that Trump might give for Mohammed bin Salman is at the moment not translating into anything concrete beyond the usual arms deals and economic deals and kind of rhetorical support. And certainly the decision to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem can only be publicly embarrassing for Trump's Saudi allies.
But in terms of a wild card, I mean, the other impetuous move that MBS made, apart from Yemen, was the blockade of Qatar. And there are certainly some fairly solid rumors over here that Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, tried to shake down the Al Thani royals because he's got this building on 666 Fifth Avenue that's been underwater since he bought it. And he's got a balloon payment of $1.2 billion due at the end of next year. He's been running around the world trying to raise money under the auspices of being Trump's special envoy. You've also got this fellow, Eric Prince, the former head of a mercenary arm at Blackwater, whose sister is the Secretary of Education. He's got a mercenary army in Dubai. And now we're learning that they have pitched Prince and, of all people, Oliver North have pitched to the Trump administration that they could form an alternative to the CIA. We know that both the Saudis and the Israelis would like America to go to war against Iran and have American boys and girls die for their foreign policy interests. So I see there's a potential for mischief in this part of the world. It wouldn't take a lot, would it, to rile up the IRGC characters running around in speedboats in the Straits of Hormuz. Do you think that it's possible that there could be some kind of incident that could lead to a broader conflagration?
Well, I certainly hope this is not going to happen. So when I talked about harsher actions by the U.S. against Iran, I certainly did not mean war or a kind of military attack anywhere. And I don't think that even with Trump's closeness to the Saudis and to the Emiratis, that the United States will be willing to fight any war for some other nation's national interests. Despite the closeness between the USA and Israel, I don't think the U.S. will go that far in satisfying Israeli interests. And therefore, I think the scenario of having U.S. military intervention in the Middle East in this way is far-fetched, thankfully. But this does not mean that the regional actors might not try something. At the moment, the situation in Syria is becoming quite concerning to the Israelis because they can see that Iran is expanding its activities in Syria. And the last thing the Israelis want is yet another Iranian-supported front like the one they have in Lebanon with Hezbollah. And therefore, of course, the Israelis are nervous. Of course, the Israelis are trying to lobby for some form of, let's say, escalated action vis-a-vis Iran. But I don't think the U.S. is going to do that, primarily because of the domestic situation in the U.S. that we were just talking about at the beginning of the interview. The fact that President Trump seems to primarily have the interests of his supporters at heart, and at the same time wants to primarily appeal to the domestic kind of audience in the U.S., means that he is not going to try to get them to agree to a war, because I don't think he would succeed.
Well, I take comfort from your words. I just am concerned that this is an administration rife with amateurism and freelancers, and we certainly know that Eric Prince and Oliver North and these people are literally trying to form an alternative CIA, and there's a mercenary army.
Yeah, but I mean, we're talking about the CIA. This is one of the oldest and most deeply established institutions in the U.S. Government. It is not so easy to establish an alternative to something as major as that. So we also have to be realistic about what can and cannot be achieved by a bunch of people with ambition. It is probably realistic to say these people would like to do something like this, perhaps, but it is certainly not realistic to imagine that they would succeed in doing so in a short period of time.
Well, Lina Hatiba, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Lina Hatiba, who's the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House, and she was previously the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.